This is a crusade. This is a holy war against the deep state.
Where are the dictators? Where are the strong men?
Donald Trump is our instrument for retribution.
I'm going to fight for Christians. I'm going to fight for white people.
They have the Great Reset. We have the Great Awakening.
And why shouldn't I root for Russia?
Because I am.
I want to see these people go through misery because of their grooming against our children.
After the assailant entered the home asking, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol.
I did nothing wrong.
Welcome to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, where we cut through the noise and help you make sense of the chaotic information space around us. I'm Griff Somke. Mike Wendling is U.S. National Digital Reporter for the BBC. He is the co-founder of the BBC's Disinformation Unit and was editor and presenter of BBC Trending. He has decades of experience covering extremism, the American far right, social media, and disinformation, and is the author of Alt-Right, From 4chan to the White House, as well as the upcoming Day of Reckoning. I'm thrilled to have him on the podcast today. Stick around. Mike, welcome to Did Nothing Wrong. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So how did you get into journalism, and how did you end up covering this really weird niche sort of subculture that blew up huge a few years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose it's a long story, and it's sort of even like further back than that, further back than 2015 or 2016, when the alt-right was really starting on the up in the popular imagination. For many years, I was a radio producer for the BBC, and, you know, I was completely sort of behind the mic and behind the camera. I made a lot of radio documentaries, and I made them about things like tech, and then the intersection with U.S. politics and culture. You know, sort of in the Obama years really led me to look at extremism of all types.
Right.
So I made a series for the BBC World Service that looked at both white nationalists and Islamist extremists who were homegrown in the U.S. I did some work on social media reporting, you know, when that thing was pretty big in, I'd say around 2012 to 2014. We had a special unit within the BBC that was dedicated to covering that in a serious way. All those things combined eventually lead you to that point where, gosh, what are all these Pepe avatars coming from, and why are they espousing Nazi ideology? And that's what in 2015 and 2016 really sort of sparked my interest in the alt-right in particular. And clearly it was the time where there was a lot of action online, a lot of chatter, but the movement was so new that there wasn't a whole lot of research or scholarship on it. That led to my first book and, you know, kind of what I've been doing up until today.
Your first book is phenomenal. It's called Alt-Right, From 4chan to the White House.
And oh, thank you. Thank you. You're too kind.
No way. This is great. It's really well researched, and it's honestly does the best job of anything I've read in covering that particular moment in politics on that side of things. Can you talk about the process involved in putting together such an involved guide to what was going on at the time?
Well, you know what? I'll give you a little bit of an inside info, because I had done a few stories about the alt-right for the BBC. I made some radio shows and wrote some stories for our website. I thought I was onto something that was much bigger than anybody thought, but that was just a hunch. And initially, when I started to pitch this around as a potential book idea, a lot of people said, I remember one book editor in particular said, "Well, you know, won't this all go away when Hillary Clinton is elected president?" Look, I mean, I've worked my entire professional career in the mainstream media, and I realize every day I'm surrounded by mainstream media people and journalists and, you know, people from the mainstream. But that sort of hit me as, gosh, what if he's wrong?
Yeah.
And of course he was. And of course, a lot of mainstream media people. And, you know, if he had sort of pinned me down in October of 2016 and forced me to choose who was going to win, I probably would have said the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have too. I would have too. Honestly, up until about 2 weeks before the election, I still thought Hillary was going to win.
And I suppose there's another thing, which is, you know, it was probably wrong on two scores, right? Number one, that Hillary Clinton would win. Number two, that the alt-right would then go away.
Right.
I think, and I argue in my new book, that actually that wasn't necessarily the case. the alt-right was an oppositional movement, they probably would have thrived under a Hillary Clinton presidency rather than the sort of breakup and the sort of infighting that we saw when Trump was president, particularly after Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Unite the Right march kind of exposed their divisions and to the rest of us, exposed the sort of hatred at the core of that whole movement.
Yeah, they couldn't really pretend they were joking any longer at that point. That was the end of the irony and the end of the, haha, well, you're just taking it seriously and you shouldn't be.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't pretend anymore. You can't continue to insist that actually you're the peaceful ones and that the other side is the very violent ones. By the other side, I mean, you know, the Antifa and anarchist type people.
Sure, sure.
When we have seen mass murder after mass murder, right? Clearly carried out by people under the sway of these far right and neo-Nazi ideologies. It's just like an untenable position. And what's interesting is, you know, you mentioned my book and in alt-right, I really did try to sort of categorize these people, the various flavors of them and the various sort of types of extremism. But that sort of freewheeling irony type, you know, which was very appealing to people who aren't necessarily at the very extreme end, has almost completely evaporated, you know?
Right.
There's still some of it out there, definitely. But in terms of the force of the larger far right, and particularly in the United States, you just don't get the sense that these people are having fun anymore.
No. And you don't get the sense that they have that same sense of kind of, as you put it in there, like playful irony. They don't really do that. You look at people like, just off the top of my head, a guy named Millennial Matt Colligan, who used to be the Hitler Did Nothing Wrong guy. He was on a bunch of the podcasts at the time. He did like Right Stuff, and he kind of walked that line of like, is he kidding? Is he not kidding? And now, from what I understand, the guy's out in Idaho and he's hardcore, very hardcore in North Idaho about this now. And he's just one of many. There's so many of them that have just dropped any pretense that this is funny or we're joking. And now they're just serious.
Yeah, exactly. And then I suppose, you know, the other flip side is of people who you've had on your podcast who realize that and turn away from it.
Right.
You know, and certainly there's plenty of those types of people, even people who were sort of very, you know, high up or influential in the movement who've done that.
Sure. I mean, like we had a guy a couple of weeks ago named Evan McLaren.
Yeah.
Who at one point was the executive director of Richard Spencer's National Policy Institute, the quote unquote think tank that he was running at the time. And the response from that episode was almost like a throwback to 2017, because we had guys like Bradley Dean Griffin and Matt Parrott, who were Charlottesville in the park guys, getting really mad at Evan. Like they were so mad that he had walked away from all of this stuff. And we even got written up on Occidental Dissent. It was pretty funny.
Oh, wow. That's an achievement.
are you still around? You actually still do that? Wow. Good job, Bradley Dean Griffin. I'm impressed.
Oh my gosh.
Even linked to it a couple times.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see why they were so upset. It was so insightful. You know, if your listeners haven't, I said this year when we were sort of off air earlier, but I was just thought, you know, this is just a brilliant sort of insight, you know, very, very sort of factual, went through his whole sort of journey and a really amazing story, really amazing.
And I think a lot of that is just simply that they can't really handle that level of rejection. Things didn't work out for them the way they thought it was going to work out and they just can't handle it. And somebody shows up from the day that is having a much better time at life at this point, and it's a real problem for them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it really struck me. And a line from that interview, and I guess I'll tell you why it struck me, but when he said, you know, when I talk to people in that world, I say, tell me about how the online politics and the alt-right particularly have anything to do with your real life day to day, right?
Yeah.
You know, the things that you're complaining about. And, you know, I think in my latest book, Day of Reckoning, I have tried to, it's obviously focused on the far right, but I see this tendency sort of across the political spectrum. And, you know, I'm kind of in a position in my day job where I'm paid, you know, not to take a side. I don't have a team.
Right.
So I can kind of hopefully it gives me a little bit more sort of clarity. I see people getting sort of wrapped up in the idea, you know, that there is a big apocalypse coming.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't mean a literal apocalypse, but I kind of mean, you know, a political seismic shift that has to do with the election. And of course, it will be a very, very big event. And I don't want to make a false equivalence either, because I think obviously, you know, there's been a lot of excellent reporting that my colleagues have done about, and many other people have done about what a second Trump presidency would do, you know, based on public documents, based on reality. Whereas, you know, when we look at the far right fever dreams, they are that. They, you know, they are tending to conspiracy. They don't have evidence. But the broader point, I suppose, is just like, hey, everybody relax, you know, whatever happens in the future will most likely not be a complete disaster, right?
Right.
If Joe Biden wins, it's not as if he's going to throw all Republicans into internment camps.
Right.
That's the kind of conspiracy we hear.
Mm-hmm. It's like he hasn't done it yet. Why not? You know?
Yes.
Come on.
And, you know, if Trump wins, it's not as if he's going to end elections. Now, there's anti-democratic things that have been laid out in various sort of policy papers, which are definitely worth covering and sort of, you know, analyzing and potentially worrying about. But the temperature is way high.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about how we got to that point. Something that you wrote in your book really resonated with me, and that's the following passage. As their voices became louder during the Trump campaign, one question nagged me. If it was true that the alt-right was made up of white males from middle America, a world I was from and instantly recognized, what was making some of them turn to a sharply reactionary, awfully baffling extreme movement? And I have written down in my notes on this, same, Mike, same. I couldn't figure out for the life of me as well, same time, how the right had moved from like basically the Tea Party to stuff that was right out of Stormfront, which, as you go into in your book, is a white supremacist message board. And like, I'm from Spokane, Washington, which is a place that you mentioned in your book. And you've been there. You kind of have an idea of what the place is like. That's where I grew up. And the idea that somehow we went from these people are conservative, these are Tea Party people, to they want to get rid of the Jews. Did you feel almost compelled at that point to try to get to the bottom of exactly what happened with all of this?
Yeah, because you know what? I'll be completely honest and say things like Gamergate kind of surprised me. And I was no sort of stranger to the dark corners of the internet.
Right.
I'd been online for many years, you know, in sort of proto-social networks. I did a whole sort of series about social networking simply because I was interested in the topic. You know, we looked at sort of the long tail and the long sort of history of online social networks. And you say like, you know, you're from Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from upstate New York, you know, a far away, but like, you know, small cities. And I don't know if there's much industry in Spokane, but certainly I grew up in a post-industrial environment.
Yeah. Not really a whole lot.
Conservatives were, like you say, like Tea Party types, or they were obsessed with cutting taxes.
Right.
And even if you thought you were going to be conservative because, you know, the teachers at your school were liberals or whatever, certainly, you know, I went through that phase and a bunch of my friends went through that phase. And, you know, we loved being transgressive or whatever because we were teenagers and idiots. So I guess it was baffling to me and it was not coherent.
Right.
But it does make a kind of sense when you think that there's definitely hardcore political operatives who are taking advantage of those things, you know?
Right, right.
And then you have a larger cohort who see that, you know, money, clout, and political success can be gained by capitalizing on that. You throw in some social media dynamics, the most inflammatory stuff gets spread. Even if inadvertently, it's cool at the time, right?
Right, right.
And I think another thing that sort of hampers the alt-right today is like, if we're talking that it burst onto the scene about 10 years ago, nearly, that's an age in internet time. And so it's not cool anymore, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like everybody who is sharing Pepe memes is okay, boomer,
Yeah, you know? It almost is at this point.
So it's a little bit passe. I mean, when you look at those kinds of things, it is right. Like, hey, you know, oh, another Nazi, yawn.
Sadly, but yes, I mean, you're right. That's exactly what it's like. It's basically like, we've all seen this a million times. We've seen a million different variants of all of this stuff. We're all way too online. And we've seen practically every variant of their memes that we're likely to see. And as a result, we're just kind of immune to it now. It's not shocking. It's just yawn. Okay, boomer.
Right. I mean, we shouldn't be too jaded because obviously there are real world impacts here that can be very violent. So I don't want to make like too much light of it. But certainly in terms of like the frothier alt-light stuff, that just seems very passe.
Yeah. What you were saying about there being, you know, some real harms caused as a result of all of this. And when you talk about the division between the alt-right and the alt-light, that's to me a very interestingly under-researched part of all of this, that there was a crew of people who were essentially Republican political operatives, guys like Jack Posobiec, who came along and essentially recruited these guys and kind of made them think they'd have a seat at the table in the Trump administration. But then when they didn't need them anymore, basically got rid of them. And now you've got a guy like Jack Posobiec, who was as deep as anybody into the 1488 memes and the Pepe memes and everything else, who is now what passes for a mainstream conservative commentator.
Yeah, I mean, that is pretty remarkable. You know, the distinction between like alt-right and alt-light is somewhat artificial because, like, you're right in saying these guys were sort of going back and forth, you know?
Right.
Jack Posobiec is probably like a really good example of that. Somebody who would sort of play with these things, you know, but then that's what irony allows you to do. You know what I mean? If you want to just trick journalists, then you're going to tell some lies.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly his exact quote, but we certainly like were talking to him when he was spreading the leak around the following year, the French presidential election in 2017.
Macron leaks, right.
Which ended up being an astonishing event.
Yeah.
Because the Macron people, you know, said we're ready for it. And at least they said that, you know, there's fakes in there and totally sort of like took the air out of the whole thing.
Right.
And it's remarkable is it was, you know, it was spread by Posobiec, you know, who had the jump on it right away, which was very, very curious.
Oh, yes. Very, very curious that he would just happen to be browsing 4chan at that specific point.
Interesting.
Gosh, what a coincidence. What a coincidence.
And is the sort of OP. Yeah. On mainstream social networks. Curious.
Very curious indeed. And that's all I'm really going to say about it because I can't prove anything else, but...
No. Right. And there's always plausible deniability. Plausible right. deniability in terms of the facts and then plausible deniability in terms of like, you know, the sort of overarching irony that all of these people used.
But, you know, I mean, go study this stuff and then tell me what you think was going on there because it's really curious. He just happened to be in that place at that time with those pieces of information. Weird.
Yeah. You know, I think if you look back at that time, it's very just interesting to see how these things have developed, you know? And of course, in 2020, the debate over Hunter Biden's laptop, right?
Right.
You know, I don't really want to sort of get into the details of that because we could, you know,
sure.
Talk a lot about that. But it was obviously handled in a completely different way by the media, by sort of like online commentators and whatnot. These things are sort of developing like very, very rapidly in terms of how we, as the press, cover them.
Right. There's definitely a sense, at least from this perspective, of they've gotten burned enough times with a story like this that they're going to be extra careful when something comes up a few weeks before an election now. People are understanding that, hey, maybe the intentions of the people that are putting this out aren't the best. Maybe they are looking for something to happen as a result of this. Maybe this information isn't good. To me, looking at the laptop, it was like, there's no such thing as chain of custody here. You can't tell me that this has been authenticated because what are we even talking about? We've got 3 or 4 hard drives that people are passing around. We've got an actual computer. This whole thing just stinks. So while there may have been something to this, it's a little hard to prove.
Right.
Because of how just kicked around the information on it has been.
Right.
So I'm really actually pretty proud of how the media handled that one, honestly, because it could have been so significantly like the same thing that happened in 2016, where they just sort of uncritically went with a lot of this information. And they didn't do that.
Yeah, you know, it was a little bit tangential. I mean, working for like a British media outlet, you know, I will sort of put in the idea that I think that, you know, people having their sort of social media accounts blocked is definitely a questionable thing in terms of mainstream media organizations, you know, like the New York Post or whatever. I don't sort of like put an opinion on one side. It's more sort of subtle to me, I guess. I can kind of see the arguments around that. But in general, though, I think you're right. It was very, very easy to be duped as a journalist in 2015 and 2016. It was very easy to do stories that would play into, for one reason or the other, what these people were trying to do.
Right.
And I think that naivete is just completely absent from journalists now. You know, we have, you know, tons of subject matter experts, and even the people who aren't necessarily experts in this subject know enough to proceed cautiously when these things happen.
Right. You absolutely can't now, because we've seen it a few times. We know how this plays out. Like I said, 2015, 2016, this was all very new to a lot of people, but not now. So I'm, like I said, pretty happy with how that one got handled, simply because it was quite clearly a stunt. And it shows that for as much as some people like to criticize, and in a lot of cases with validity, the way the mainstream media handles things, that the mainstream media did learn, and that the mainstream media is learning from what were previous mistakes of how to handle these sorts of things. So give them that, because there's going to be more of this. There's going to be more stories that are going to come up between now and the election. And I think that they've definitely sort of figured out how to avoid being played on that level now, which is a good thing. So I've got this one question, and since you were around a lot and you've researched a lot of the beginnings of this stuff, maybe you got an answer for me. You mentioned in your book, in the incident on Inauguration Day in 2017, where alt-right leader Richard Spencer was punched while giving an on-camera interview, and the assailant got clean away. And what I find interesting about that is that although the video was probably viewed literally billions of times, the assailant never got conclusively identified. There were a couple of what we call fail doxes, which they claimed that this is the guy, and it turned out not to be the guy. But they never actually figured out the actual perpetrator, which is weird, because usually people figure that kind of thing out when this kind of thing happens. Why do you think they never caught the guy?
That is so interesting. It really is. I don't know why. And you know what? I particularly don't know why, you know, Richard Spencer is... You know, his reputation is gone sort of steadily downhill. He's had some sort of weird and nonsensical, I guess, political developments, you know, like supporting Joe Biden simply because he thinks Joe Biden will be good for white people. Mm-hmm. I really haven't sort of like plunged into that weirdness. You would think that the person who did that might actually claim credit at some point, right?
Right.
Like maybe they would out themselves, because that clearly, you know, they could build a whole career on the back of that.
I know. He doesn't really have any friends that are going to come beat you up at this point or anything.
Right, right. On the other hand, I suppose maybe you're still worried about like criminal prosecution. I think maybe police in Washington have bigger things to deal with at the moment. But
yeah,
you know what? It is curious, and I have no explanation of why that is, but I'm sure that I could invent a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, that's about where we're at on this.
I mean, I thought about it too hard.
I think if you have to like come up with an answer at this point, I think the answer almost has to be it was one of his friends, and that they set the whole thing up and did it on purpose, because, you know, it makes Richard look good. He gets up and he's just like, yeah, but it didn't quite play out the way they thought it was going to play out. It turned into this meme.
You know, I never thought about that possibility. I suppose it's within the realm of possibility.
I mean, all they have to do is have somebody put on a balaclava and just hit him. Nobody would have known the difference.
I wonder, though, how that person wouldn't get doxxed by Antifa people. They tend to sort of keep a good sort of tabs on Richard Spencer and his crew.
If anybody has a good theory, feel free to email me here at the show. I'm really, really curious about that, and I always have been. So,
yeah. You know, unexplained mysteries.
Definitely.
I think a lot of people get involved in these conspiracy theories because probably like you, you know, I was always sort of interested in conspiracy theories from the point of view of, well, let me put it like this. Lenny Posner, who his child died at Sandy Hook, and he spent many years fighting against the conspiracy theories about Sandy Hook and about and against Alex Jones. He put it to me like this. He said, you know, I was always interested in conspiracy theories because they were like mental chewing gum. At the end of the day, when I had my sort of boring office job, I could just go home and just sort of let my mind wander about, hey, you know, if the moon landing was faked, how would they fake it? Oh, interesting theory. Not necessarily that he was sort of buying into them or, you know, wanting to invade the Capitol because of them. And, you know, they are. They're like, they're endlessly fascinating. And certainly for myself and I think other people who sort of work in this space, and you can tell me if you're one of these people too, that's how you first sort of get interested in this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I was an Art Bell listener growing up.
Oh, yes, yes.
Big fan.
Absolutely.
I mean, I come from a radio background as well, and one of the jobs I had at one point was I was a board operator for the Art Bell show.
Wow.
So I got to listen to a lot of Art Bell in the mid-90s, which was kind of fun.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and the thing I liked best about Art is he would kind of uncritically listen to you. He would have some of the just most out there people on the show, and they would get the closest thing to a fair hearing they're probably ever going to get from anybody in media, because that was just Art.
Yes.
He would just absolutely believe you.
He was so good at radio. I mean, I like to tell this story of like in the late 90s, I was at college in Ohio and I was hanging out with all these punks, and, you know, we were all hanging out at the college radio station, but it came to a certain point in the evening when everybody was like trying to chill out. And just flip on Coast to Coast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And just have sort of like a wild time discussing all this stuff, the phone-ins. Yeah.
It was definitely the soundtrack to a good chunk of my life, was listening to that guy on the overnights and being like, you know, I don't believe a lot of what he's talking about, but it's still very interesting because this is all stuff nobody talks about besides him. It's the only place you're going to hear some of these ideas at the time.
Yeah.
So in the year 2024, the alt-right is, for all intents and purposes, done. It doesn't really exist anymore. However, one thing it did manage to accomplish, I think, is it got a lot of these ideas into the discourse. And they managed to do quite a bit of that on both sides. You talked about a guy named Curtis Yarvin in your book, who went from relative obscurity to having his ideas picked up on by people like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. And then when Charlottesville happened, as we talked about earlier, people who are more on the left saw what that looked like. And in some cases, they saw real Nazis here and became convinced on a level that wasn't ordinarily possible that the threat was real. And I think that for whatever else it did, it pushed the discourse in this country into a place where it's going to be really hard to come back from that and go back to a pre-alt-right time in where we kind of related to each other on this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would sort of go a little bit further, because I think that it was not necessarily, I think if anybody who's sort of says, oh yeah, I'm on the left politically, was probably well aware of the potential danger of the alt-right before Charlottesville. You know what I mean?
Right.
In fact, it was a more broad-based, you know, sense of who these people really were amongst all sorts of people, you know?
Right.
Left, right, and center, and none of the above. Yeah, I mean, these ideas, it's in some ways, it's sort of, it depends on the ideas. It depends on, you know, who exactly we're talking about. Certainly, in the character of Donald Trump, it's like you have somebody who's talking about things that conservatives haven't talked about for a while. To the extent that he's sort of picked up some of these ideas on the far right and the alt-right, of course, like, you know, that's debatable and it depends on issues. And, you know, he's a fairly sort of erratic person as a candidate. So the things that he might emphasize, you know, sort of shift from day to day. So I think probably your point, though, is one that I might agree with, which is a lot of these things just weren't being talked about 10 years ago.
Right.
And a lot of them seem almost like, you know, throwbacks, you know, like particularly the hardcore race science type stuff.
Right.
You know, people weren't having sort of debates about this 20 years ago.
No, they weren't. And these guys kicked that into the mainstream. And now we're talking Great Replacement. Now we're talking, you know, crime stats again, and we're doing all the rest of it. And to some extent, you can thank those guys because they were the ones that figured out how to get people talking about it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can also say, well, you know, Donald Trump and his cronies were posting these memes and, you know, still are to some degree.
Right.
It's not exclusive to the right. And I guess it's like part of the sort of information sphere that we have now. You know, you can take some very sort of left-wing ideas too and say, you know, people weren't talking about this kind of stuff. You know, I keep seeing things about, to take something at random, polyamory.
Right.
You know, there's a hell of a lot of coverage of polyamory. Now, 25 years ago, I remember seeing this stuff in, you know, punk magazines and like niche zines and stuff like this, right?
Right.
Not in the New York Times. And there's many different explanations you could make for that, but certainly like the social media revolution is part of it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. People now have a place to discuss some of these ideas. And it's not just, you know, the white supremacists that have found each other. It's every niche subculture can all talk now. And it's pushed things faster and farther ahead in a very short period of time than we may have been ready for as a species. I think that all of a sudden things are quite sped up from what we have been used to. The pace that we have been used to society kind of proceeding at has quickened, as it were. Some people would say accelerated. You know, that's just where we're at these days. So you wrote a piece called How Not to Amplify Bad Ideas, which is an explanation of how you and your colleagues at BBC Trending decide whether or not to cover certain things. And I thought it was really fascinating, well thought out look at the decision tree that you use, because that's something that everybody who's in any sort of media has to make a call on. Like, how much time do you want to spend on some of these people and some of these ideas? And are we making it worse when we talk about them versus this is news, this needs to get talked about? I mean, you don't want to let some of these people have the only say in what gets out there. So can you walk me through how the process works for like a typical story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so, you know, okay, I'll put it like this. Amplification was something that was sort of batted around quite a lot. Maybe not so much anymore, but certainly in the recent past, the discussions about whether you should cover a particular thing. And, you know, because we at the BBC have a large general audience, we have to keep that in mind. I mean, the audience is the key thing, I suppose, you know,
right.
The assumptions that people make. And, you know, we can be assured that if I'm going to write a story on the far right, if I'm going to do a radio broadcast or if I'm going to put something on our website, that will expose it to people who haven't heard it before.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So the calculus is, well, multifold. It's how many people have already heard about it. Today, I'm looking into a flyer that may be a fake that is saying that, you know, a charity in Mexico is encouraging people to cross the border and vote for Joe Biden.
Ah.
Now, there's some highly suspicious things about this flyer, so I'm going to look into that. But the background of that is this isn't being circulated on 4chan. It's being circulated to millions, perhaps tens of millions of people on websites, on Twitter, via some of these people, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, how many people have already seen it? And of course, like, context was really important, being able to add context, you know, because I think actually a lot of maybe sort of amateur media criticism, I won't go so like too far in defending like, you know, mainstream media, whatever that means. I'm not a spokesman for the mainstream media here, but, you know, there was at a certain time sort of like the idea that you should never talk to these people because that would be platforming them.
Right. Right.
And certainly I, you know, like I describe it, you know, my job is to talk to these people.
Yeah.
It literally is to give them, you know, and in some ways a fair hearing, you know, a fair might be if you are going to espouse neo-Nazi views to me, if you are going to espouse, you know, the view that vaccines kill millions of people, yes, I will reflect that. But fair is also, I will fact check that.
Right.
And, you know, being fair to the audience is giving them the truth compared to your anti-vax conspiracy theories, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And our calculus, again, our calculus is this very large general news media, and, you know, particularly within the UK, you know, is enormously influential, is going to be different from, you know, us talking on this podcast, even me writing in the book. You know, I will go into a level of detail, and perhaps, you know, I would mention stories that I wouldn't necessarily put in something for a more general audience.
Right, right.
People have their own standards, and people who work in the information space can make up their own minds on that one.
Yeah. It's really kind of a tough call, it seems, every single time. And you make a good point about how it's one thing to talk about these things in front of a smaller audience. It's another thing to talk about these things in front of arguably one of the largest media outlets in the world that is going to put this stuff on display in front of millions, if not tens of millions of people when you talk about it.
You know, and a lot of the time it's like people get audiences on social media or in podcasting that far outweigh their ability to sort of deal with those questions.
Right.
I'm thinking of basically the world's most famous, most popular podcaster, right?
Right.
You know, I think if I was Joe Rogan, I would probably think long and hard about what I'm going to do, the kinds of people I'm going to put on, and how I'm going to contextualize them.
Right. And it really seems when you listen to it that the guy is in kind of over his head when it comes to a lot of this. Like, I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I'm from that same world. So, like, I know where Joe's coming from. I know who some of those early guests were. It was him and Eddie Bravo and some of those weird people that they had around the gym just kind of talking about goofy stuff. And now they're in a position where they're the biggest podcast in the world. And he has a ridiculously large number of people who tune in all the time. And that's kind of, whether you like it or not, that's great power, great responsibility stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You nailed it. It's like, you know, just have a think about it. And I always say, as a journalist, I'm like, you know, the de facto view that we take. And, you know, my colleagues work in very repressive media environments, right?
Right.
And I have been to countries that, you know, score really down on that list of media freedom.
Right.
Right. Like, we're pro speech. We're not like coming out to like cancel anyone. You know what I mean?
No.
As an organization, you know, we don't take sides. I'm paid not to pick a team. I don't have an official opinion. I'm not here to say this should be canceled or not, or censored or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's just not the debate we're playing. But certainly I think it's legitimate to point out, yes, you've had some bullshit on your podcast. Maybe you should think twice about putting some bullshit on your podcast in the future.
Yeah.
Maybe you should just do a little bit of fact checking.
Yeah. It's like, you've had guys like Stefan Molyneux and Chuck Johnson on your podcast. To me, that's irresponsible.
Chuck Johnson, he's a funny one. I mean, he
really is a funny guy.
I was starting to read his Substack for a while, and I just, it's utterly bizarre. It's utterly bizarre to me. In the alt-right days, I could sort of just, you know, put him into the, yes, he's some sort of alt-right troll using these memes. I just don't know what to make heads or tails of these days. I'm pretty baffled by it.
Well, my gut feeling is that he's still trying to do anti-Semitism without coming out and saying that. Like, someday I would love to just sit him down and say, Chuck, settle it all right now. How many people died in the Holocaust? Give me a number. Just come on, Chuck. How many? Everybody calls you a Holocaust denier. You could settle all this right now. You could clear all of this up. Just what is your answer to that question? How many people? And see what he says. Just straight up ask that question.
Well, you know, and the mechanics of it, obviously he would never give you like a straight answer.
Right.
I wouldn't think.
Phone
us up and tell us, Chuck, if you're listening. But
he might be, actually.
Those alt-right characters, I'm just sort of like, it's been a while since I've been completely sort of immersed, so I don't sort of keep in touch with all of them or keep tabs on all of them. But I am just sort of curious about, like, you know, what their grift is these days and how they're managing to survive. I mean, you know, that doesn't really occupy much of my time, let's be honest. I'm passing curiosity.
Yeah. So, you know, Chuck, if you ever want to give that answer, you know, yeah, feel free. Shoot me a message. You know where we are. You know what we do. So you've got a new book coming out real shortly. It's called Day of Reckoning. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is follows this kind of exactly on because, you know, the sort of, as we were saying, the freewheeling hype machine that was the alt-right has sort of hardened into actual Nazis and people who were disillusioned with the whole scene. I trace how conspiracy has become the dominant theme of the far right. Obviously, you know, it was always there. It is always there. It's not exclusive to the right wing or the far right, but it is completely sort of overwhelmed these people from Pizzagate all the way through to, I guess you might call mainstream conspiracy theories about voter fraud and so forth.
Right.
It's curious that this has become a trend because at the same time, the far right and the people who are pushing these kinds of things have crept ever closer to the mainstream, particularly in American politics. And so you have a substantial numbers of people in Congress who, you know, back the voter fraud, the conspiracy theories, you know, are pushing other sorts of conspiracy theories too. You know, in general, they're using it to hype up, again, what we were talking about before, which is this sense of doom.
Right.
When the irony and the freewheelingness goes away, all you're left with is paranoia. And there's some extremely paranoid people who are becoming very influential in this world.
Definitely, definitely. And it's going to play out, I think, in a very interesting way. Where do you see the elections going in 2024? What are your early feelings about where we're at right now? I know you aren't picking a team, and I'm not asking you to.
I'm not picking a team, and more than that, I'm not making a prediction either. Sorry.
No worries.
You know, having lived in the UK for a couple of decades, my British friends, you know, I'm sort of like the go-to American for a lot of my British friends. So I get this question a lot. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I always say, I have no particular insight. You know, if you were listening to me in 2016, I was wrong about that. You would have been misled. So just don't trust me on anything predicted wise. I like to tell people, you know what, just be prepared for anything. Right.
Right.
And also be prepared for anything not being the worst thing that could potentially happen, whatever side you are on, whatever team that you're picking. Let me put it like this. I think that in some ways we've sort of maybe invested a little bit too much as political junkies, but it's a big presidential election. Yeah, it's news, right?
Right.
Now, Donald Trump and others, and I don't want to just sort of like single him out, wouldn't be fair, say this is the most important election in American history or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Is that true? Was the election of 1860 perhaps a little bit more important? You know, I think we've had a pretty important election in 1932 and 1944. You know, you get my point.
Looking back, the 2000 election was quite important. Nobody really thought that at the time, but here we are.
I mean, the alternative history where Al Gore is in the White House on 9/11 is very
fascinating.
Just interesting fascinating to contemplate. Has anybody written that novel yet? I mean,
there's a God, what is the dude's name? He wrote it. Same guy that wrote Then Everything Changed. He actually wrote that up as a novella. And I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he did actually write it.
I'm going to have to check that one out. So yeah, you know, I'm focusing on the far right, but this is not a tendency that is limited to the far right.
Right.
It's to sort of put all the chips on November the 5th. You know, the sun will come up the next day. No matter who you voted for, there will be things to do the next day in your own personal life and in the realm of politics, if you are so inclined.
Okay.
So when I'm talking about specifically about the far right and the accelerationists and the fringes, that is pretty scary when you sort of combine paranoia with this sense of like, there is going to be a day in the future where that is the day of reckoning.
Yeah.
It's a trick title. In other words, I'm trying to argue against the fact or against the idea that it's all down to one day.
Right. Right.
Despite what some people on the fringes would like us to believe.
So how do you unplug from this stuff to keep yourself from going insane?
Well, I have, in general, a very normal life, and I like to watch some sports in my spare time and drive my children around my leafy neighborhood.
Nice.
And the liberal bubble in our Chicago neighborhood where we live.
Okay.
In some ways, it's interesting because even though I'm covering news in the United States, and it's much more dramatic and violent, and I've done a lot more sort of gruesome stories that here than I have done in years, I'm unplugged a lot from the 4chans and the 8chans of the world. I'm not on there all the time. So that part of it is easier. I think we have definitely, as a sort of industry, had a lot more sort of awareness of mental health,
right,
and things to do to protect your mental health. And then, you know, even though I was looking at extremist content and still do quite a lot, you know, I'll just keep getting back to, I have colleagues who are in war zones, you know, yeah. They're in Kiev, they're in Gaza. And I mean, this isn't the front line. I don't want to sort of minimize it because, you know, there's other colleagues of mine have gotten like horrible abuse and it's not good, but perspective helps.
Right. Nobody's shooting at you. And that's definitely something that we can all wake up every day and be grateful for.
Hopefully nobody's shooting at us.
Yes.
Hopefully. Long may that continue.
Indeed. So how can people support you and the work you're doing?
So you can log on to look at my work on the BBC. And, you know, it's obviously not just me. We have, I was one of the editors of the BBC who started what was then known as the disinformation team.
Right.
And so I have a lot of colleagues who do a lot of great work. And, you know, there's a lot of different media outlets who are doing a ton of great work. They come from different political perspectives and backgrounds, of course. So, of course, I'm going to plug mine. But, you know, like, I probably don't need to tell any of your listeners to remain grounded in reality because, you know, they listen to you.
We do our best. We really do our best here.
My book, again, is called Day of Reckoning. It is out on the 20th of May. So, by all means, take a look wherever you get your books from, whether that be your local store, your library.
Right, right.
So I'm excited. There's a lot of stories in there that I have told in other ways, but there's fresh details and I go into quite a lot more sort of depth in terms of the background and sort of tying it all together.
Right, right. And I definitely have to put another plug in for alt-right from 4chan to the White House because, again, if you're looking to understand kind of how we got here, if you're looking to understand that particular time in history, this book explains it about as well as anything I've read. So feel free to pick that up when you're picking up your copy of Day of Reckoning. Mike, thank you so much for coming on. This was great. Enjoyed talking to you quite a bit.
Yeah, thanks for having me. No, it was super interesting. Definitely. Yeah.
And we'll have to have you on again sometime.
Anytime.
All right. Well, hey, thanks very much. You have a great rest of your day and we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find us on the web at didnothingwrongpod.com. Please make sure you subscribe to get our content straight into your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at GrizzaBJJ, GrzaBJJ, as well as DNWPod. We're extremely grateful for paid subscriptions and donations that allow us to keep doing this important work. Thanks, and remember, everyone mentioned did nothing wrong.